The next case is 95-2497, Emmanuel Jones versus Thomas H. Hartranft, M.D. Mr. Walsh.
The weight's a good issue.
May it please the court. The threshold issue in this case, Your Honors, is a failure to prosecute. Now, the appellants in this case have filed that under our third proposition of law. However, it doesn't need to be addressed when the rest of the plaintiff in this case has never conceded and has never denied that this was a failure to prosecute. The appellate court never indicated that it was not a failure to prosecute. The trial court correctly found that this was probably a perfect example of a failure to prosecute. In this case, the plaintiff having 4 years, essentially, to find evidence to establish medical malpractice against my clients, never was able to find that evidence. Comes to the court on the day of trial and says, Your Honor, I don't have any evidence, I need a continuance. They discuss it, the court decides to deny the continuance. The court asks the plaintiff, what do you want to do now?
Okay, let me interrupt you there. Is that what he came to the court and said?
Excuse me?
Came to the court and said, I don't have any evidence?
That's what he said, Your Honor. He said, and I'm quoting from the transcript at this point, we're not prepared to go to trial at this time because of problems in obtaining and preparing an expert witness. I believe that we could go to trial certainly on the dates in March, April, and May, and possibly even on the ones in February if required to do so. Well, Your Honor,
maybe I'm being nitpicky this morning, I don't know, but you just stood up here and said, the lawyer came in and said to the judge, I don't have any evidence, so I need... That is exactly what he said. I don't have a key witness in place. That's different than saying I don't have any evidence.
Well, Your Honor, I would note that you're correct in one aspect of that. He did have some evidence. Obviously, he has the evidence of his client who's going to testify that what my client did was wrong. But he doesn't have any probative evidence of it because he doesn't have an expert. And as this court is well aware, in a medical malpractice case, the plaintiff has an absolute obligation to present expert testimony on that issue unless it is something like removal of the wrong leg or whatever that a jury could find without the help of expert testimony. In this case, we're dealing with a procedure which occurred in 1976-77 and which allegedly should have been corrected long before it was. How is the jury supposed to decide that without an expert? They can't. And the plaintiff in this case didn't have mentioned.
It seems to me the reason that the trial court dismissed the case was that the two parties couldn't agree on a continuance. It seems a little ridiculous, doesn't it?
Well,
didn't he tell the parties, now listen guys, get together, give me a continuance date, agree on that date and come back. Well, they couldn't agree on a date, so he dismissed it. Isn't that a little unusual that the court would use that as a dismissal reason, other than some logical, legally sound reason?
I would disagree with Your Honor's characterization of what happened prior to the dismissal. In this case, what happened was the court told the parties, you guys try to get together on this. And as this court is well aware, having talked to the jury, hundreds of trial judges.
My point being, if the court at that point felt that he had very good reason to throw the case out because the plaintiff was not ready, had not been ready, and never would be ready, why then would he ask the parties to go and get an agreed date for a continuance?
He would ask that precise question, Your Honor, precisely why we're here today. Because the court realizes that if he can get the parties to agree to something, there's not going to be any error for that thing. Whatever that thing is, whether it's a submission of evidence in the case, an expert request for continuance,
that the court
was insane.
You're telling me here today that the court was more interested in error than in justice.
Your Honor, if there's error, there's no justice. So those two things go together. If there's error, there can't be justice. If there's justice, there isn't any error. But they're not things that conflict with each other. What the court was trying to do was give the parties an opportunity to work out this disagreement. Now, obviously, counsel for the defense can't very well agree to a continuance, and counsel knows that the plaintiff doesn't have any evidence.
But wasn't there something else in this case, too, that the case was originally, when it was refiled, was put on a two-year trial track, and then the judge changed that to a one-year track?
Correct.
Isn't that part of the case?
That is part of the case, and the appellate court found that to be error. And we presented several reasons why the appellate court was incorrect in that determination. The first being, the error was this issue was never raised until the day of oral argument. When Mr. Rome shows up for oral argument, the appellate court starts asking about this local rule. It wasn't raised by any parties. It wasn't presented as any briefs whatsoever. Now, we've cited in our brief Local Rule 45. And Local Rule 45 allows the court to sua sponte, change the trial date without good cause, without any kind of service of anything to anybody, simply by providing notice. Notice is all that was required.
Well, and here we had, I guess the trial court could take notice of the fact, although I guess it wasn't mentioned, but only incidentally could take notice of the fact that this is a plaintiff who's done this before. I mean, filed a claim, and here's a defendant, you know, getting discovery and spending money. Plaintiff comes in under Rule 41 and can dismiss. He does with no, I mean, for whatever reason he wants to. There's no check on it by the trial judge. Now he comes back and he does essentially the same thing. It seems to me that the trial judge, well, before he does, it seems to me the trial judge, in his discretion, could put this case on a faster track since they'd been through this once before. I mean, the defendant's justice in this also needs to be considered. It seems to me that you file a suit against someone, you put him through the expense and whatever else comes with a civil suit, and then right before the trial, you dismiss it, file again, same thing, right before the trial, you dismiss it. It seems to me that at some point, the trial judge has discretion here to say enough. And it seems to me that's really what happened here. The trial judge was prepared to dismiss, but he apparently thought, well, if the two can agree to a continuance, I'll accept it. But I have a real problem with the Court of Appeals. I'm really surprised the Court of Appeals opinion, frankly, without any standard of abuse of discretion, just says you have to consider something less than a dismissal.
Mm-hmm.
I don't quite follow that, I guess. That's the other argument, of course, that's in the case. But isn't that, I mean, if I boiled it down, made it too simple, maybe not for your side, but probably for the plaintiff's side I have, but... But excuse me, that's what's going on. I mean, the trial judge has to control, the docket has to control the case flow, and here's a plaintiff who just doesn't seem to be able to get an expert. And how much time are you going to give him to get an expert? You know, what's reasonable? The trial judge decided you've had your time. That's the case, it seems to me.
Thank you, Your Honor. That's exactly our case. That's exactly how we presented in our brief.
However, there's a local rule that requires a motion for the continuance to file so many days before trial, and as signed by the client, was a written motion ever filed in this case to continue it?
The written motion in this case, Your Honor, was filed on Friday, the Friday before the Monday scheduled trial date. So that local rule was not
filed. Did the Court of Appeals direct the plaintiff to follow that local rule by the
attorney? No, Your Honor, they didn't. They apparently didn't feel that would support their reasoning in the case.
Did you raise that issue?
No, we didn't, Your Honor. Mainly because that wasn't the primary focus of the case. As Chief Justice Moyer pointed out, the real issue here is we've got a case where the plaintiff has had 4 years essentially to find the evidence he needs to present a case, has dismissed the case once voluntarily as is allowed by the rule, and the defense had absolutely no problem with that, even the trial court, but then refiled it within a year. You would think that during that year prior period where he wasn't before the court, he would have been doing more work to try to find somebody. If he did or didn't, we don't know. It's really not important. What is important is he had all the time to do it.
When the judge advanced it from the two-track to the one-year track, did the plaintiff attorney raise any objection to the advance? File any objection to it? So if a rule allows
that he was having any kind of problems finding an expert. Never said anything to anybody. In fact, we had people who tell us what he had in the case. We had to move to compel to get his hands our interrogatories. This is simply a case where 20 years after, almost 20 years after the fact now, they want to say that what Dr. Hartman did was medical malpractice. Well, Your Honor, respectfully, they need somebody to say that. They can't say it. I can't even say it. We need a doctor to say it. They didn't have a doctor who could say that.
Let's talk about the standard of review from our counsel. Is it your position, the standard of review we know is abuse of discretion, but is that standard to be applied to either or both of these issues? The first issue being whether there was a failure to prosecute, and the second issue being what sanctions should we apply having found a failure to prosecute. Are both those issues reviewed under an abuse of discretion standard?
Well, it depends. I guess the way to answer that is kind of break down a little bit. First, regarding the first part of your question, that is correct. Anytime a trial court finds a failure to prosecute or reviews it to find a failure to prosecute, regardless, that should be analyzed under an abuse of discretion standard. And as this court well aware, unreasonable or arbitrary or unconscionable, their disjunctive will not be known. Now, once a failure to prosecute has been found, then it really depends on what the trial court does. If the trial court dismisses the case with prejudice, it is our position that that's what the rule says. The rule says that any dismissal for failure to prosecute is with prejudice, unless the trial court decides to find otherwise. Unless. So at this point, where a trial court says, you failed to prosecute, I'm dismissing this case with prejudice, there can't be an abuse of discretion. So therefore, the analysis needs to be that the trial court follow the law. And therefore, it's more or less.
It's an error of law.
An error of law.
Review it under that standard, the sanction imposed.
Exactly.
In as much as it was a dismissal.
For the first half of the question. Now, if the trial court, let's say in this case, the trial court decides to dismiss the case without prejudice, then this court would analyze that, and the appellate court should analyze that under an abuse of discretion. At that point, you would decide to sit down and say, now, is it fair to the defendant? Chief Justice Moore pointed out, is it fair to the defendant to be exposed to this kind of lawsuit for many, many years without any kind of resolution?
And it's unfair to the plaintiff. I mean, we also have to look at the plaintiff. Did the plaintiff have a fair amount of time to find an expert? Was it expected that this would make a difference? You'd look at it both ways on an abuse of discretion, wouldn't you?
Correct. Now, in this case, one thing I would like to point out, for us in the legal profession, not judges and attorneys, we see lawsuits every day. Lawsuits, after a while, are no big deal. Everybody gets sued. So it's like, somebody calls up, I just got sued. Everybody gets sued. But to the individual who's been sued, they've never been sued more likely than not. And even if they have, they don't get sued that often. Even Mount Carmel deals with thousands of cases every year, are not even reported every day. This is not the kind of thing that always happens. And Dr. Hartman, as an individual, gets sued even less than an institution like Mount Carmel. So we would indicate that when a plaintiff sues somebody, they have an obligation to proceed, because that defendant, to them, their world now is, I've been sued. Somebody said, I did something wrong. I hurt somebody. They say, I'm responsible. I should pay for it. And that's all they think about. That's something that focuses on them every day. Again, failure to prosecute in this case has been admitted. There's no dispute as to that. The question really before this court is, what should the trial court do once that has been found? The rule is clear, absolutely clear. Dismissals for failure to prosecute are with prejudice, unless the court decides otherwise. The court in this case correctly found that there was simply no expectation that the plaintiff would ever have an expert in the future. He didn't have anybody. To this day, we don't know if he has anybody. He certainly hasn't informed us of this. And I don't think he's informed the court that he has suddenly found an expert in this case. We would ask that this court reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals and reinstate the decision of the trial court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Walsh. Mr. Pease.
Our brief on the merits is filed before the court sustained the motion to strike the supplemental defendant, which contained matters that were outside the record of this case. Unfortunately, the brief still contained references to that supplemental, and the court ordered the struck the entire supplement or just a portion of the record. The record in this case does not support the factual assertions upon which defendants base their appeal as to dilatory tactics, which are characterized as counter malicious, such as the courts have consistently required for dismissal with prejudice. Not even those things inserted in the record improperly and supplemented by the defendants to support the defendants of dilatory tactics on the part of defendants in this counsel.
What would you call them?
I would call them, there were problems with the case. The only major problem of the case, not from my own labor, was the patient claiming it wasn't good for the claim. First told the plaintiff that he and his colostomy should have been taken down and he testified that the doctor didn't do it. It was clearly at fault. Dr. Labor, after numerous contacts by me, began to back down about 8 to 10 months before. This case was set for trial. I was in the process of doing this. I will accept responsibility for not earlier making the motions to the court to continue the case because of a single problem with the expert witness. There was no failure to do discovery. That's asserted by the witness. We did all the discovery we needed. Our only problem was an expert witness backed up.
They said you didn't do any, so what are you saying you did?
We got copies of the hospital records, and took this, the defendants discovered their position. That's all I needed to do to prepare this case. The question in this case is, why didn't you take down this colostomy in 1978, which Dr. Labor took down in 15 years or 17 years later? I took the discovery deposition of the defendant despite.
Well, counsel, when did the alleged malpractice occur specifically?
Over a period of years, starting in about 1977, when the surgery was originally done, the patient kept going back to the doctor saying, oh, I won't take this thing down, I can't work, I'm working in. He did work some, but he was working on an uneducated working man, and he was told repeatedly over time, this is testimony to show, although that's not a good record. His colostomy could not be removed until finally when he put in the clinic. They went out and said, yes, can we sure it a long time ago and they're moved it. Is that okay?
Okay, so if it's such a simple matter, and the state of practicing medicine was in as early as, what, 78 or 79, that you could reverse this type of surgery and to hook him up so he could enjoy a normal life. Why didn't you have an expert by the, certainly by the time of the second trial?
I can give you an answer, Your Honor, but it isn't supported by the record. The answer is very complex. It involves financing, getting expert witnesses, the difficulty of finding expert witnesses in malpractice cases, which has been acknowledged by some of the other courts in this state, and communication between consultants.
But, well, let's bring it up to date. Is there an expert lurking about in the wings in this case?
I'm confident, Your Honor, that I can handle an expert on this case if we are set for trial. Again, it's a total trial court case, and nobody disagreed with
it. Okay. How do you know you even have a malpractice case if you don't have an expert?
I have an expert. He backed out. He told me he's the expert. He's in labor.
Okay, but
he backed out and said
I challenge your opponent on his bald-faced assertion that you went to the trial judge and said, I don't have any testimony. I thought that was a little much, and I thought you probably didn't go in and say that specifically.
That's true.
All right. But in a broader sense, what he was saying is, you don't have an expert, therefore you don't have a case, period.
And that I said at that point, when I went to the trial judge, when I filed a motion on Friday before the trial date on Monday, essentially I was saying, at this point I don't have an answer. I have now confirmed in my own mind that I can't use the record. And I need more time to get another one. The defense had already filed a motion, which was to see what continuance and listed dates so it was were accepted to there.
How long do you expect any litigant should be subject to being jerked around and have to pay a lawyer to come to the courthouse? When a plaintiff still hasn't figured out that they even have a case. I mean, this has gone on, went on how long?
Well,
3 years?
No, it went on a little over a year in this filing. There was a year interval between dismissal, voluntary dismissal, and filing, during which the record says nothing about this case.
3 years.
There were activities that went on during the first filing, which lasted about a year, during which the record shows nothing as to what was going on. The only thing the record shows as to what was going on is what I said to the trial court hearing.
Help me with the notion that I'm getting, that this is just absolutely the classic of what doctors and insurance companies complain about.
The only thing I can say, Your Honor, is one of the reasons that the trial court, and this local rule sets a 2-year docket for situations such as this. Now, I have to admit, this case was an old case. When it was first filed, it was even more than it was refiled. The opportunity to, the only issue is, can you talk to an expert? If you've got unlimited resources and you can apply their agreement, then can you talk to an expert sooner than that? Yes, I could have. I accept responsibility for the fact that at the time this case was set for trial, we did not at that moment have an expert. The record doesn't say why. So that's my job to assume responsibility.
Isn't it your job to say to the client when you first interview him, hey, experts cost a lot of money. Experts are hard to find. You may or may not have a case, and here's the deal. Now, are you in or out?
Yes. That's my duty.
Yes, it can be.
Okay.
The question of being discussed here by defense counsel, I think for the first time, is was there a failure to prosecute? And under the case law that has existed up until today, it isn't very important. And maybe there was a failure to prosecute, because all the cases have described failure to prosecute showing a wide range of circumstances in which the courts have said there may or may not have been an abuse of discretion by the trial court in dismissing when it finds failure to prosecute. None of the courts have said what the defense now says, which is, if there's a failure to prosecute, Civil Rule 41 is mandatory, and you must dismiss with prejudice. If the trial lawyers and the trial judges all believe that 41B was mandatory, the trial court had no discretion upon finding failure to prosecute, we would have had a lot of litigation about what is or is not a failure to prosecute. And I suggest to this court that failure to prosecute is a very ambiguous term which covers a lot of things from very mild to very serious, such as in the Lorenz case, which this court found numerous dilatory tactics and said that the trial court could consider a prior trial, prior filing case in determining whether there was a failure to prosecute and whether there were dilatory practices.
But to say, Mr. Pease, to say that the trial court perhaps could have considered something less than a dismissal doesn't mean that the rule requires the trial court to do that. The rule doesn't say anything about looking at lesser sanctions for failure to prosecute.
The rule is silent on that. The courts of appeals and this court have held numerous times in recycled cases that the trial court, when it looks at a failure to prosecute and decides whether to dismiss, has discretion, has sound discretion, and can be reversed when it is discretion. And I heard that Your Honor say a few minutes ago that the Court of Appeals decision here did not appear to find an abuse of discretion. I respectfully disagree. It clearly found an abuse of discretion.
Well, but it didn't state much of a standard, I didn't think. It just said that the Court of Appeals failed to consider lesser sanctions, and I don't think that's the standard for abuse of discretion.
I don't think that is even the basis of the Court of Appeals decision.
Okay.
The failure to impose lesser sanctions under these circumstances is one basis, and the other basis is the one of the defendants that are mentioned.
But you see, that's the problem. There isn't any requirement any place, except in the Court of Appeals opinion, that a trial court consider that. I mean, if Rule 41 said trial court, if there's a failure to prosecute, you must consider this, this, and this, or you must consider sanctions that, you know, building up to a dismissal, that'd be one thing, but the rule doesn't require that. I guess that's...
The rule says nothing about how the trial court goes about exercising its discretion. As far as I know, none of the civil rules say what is or is not an abuse of discretion in applying the rules. So to say that the trial court was not mandated to consider lesser sanctions by the rule, to me, doesn't tell us anything. What tells us something is what the appellate courts and this court have said about how the trial court goes about it and what constitutes an abuse of discretion. This court and the appellate courts have found abuses of discretion in other concerns which are cited in practice or dismissals with prejudice without considering lesser sanctions. Now, if the only issue were, are you going to endorse the one court of appeals decision which says, all I accept, failure to consider lesser sanctions is an abuse of discretion, we would have to. There are several other issues here, one which the court of appeals can discuss. In the trial court, the issue was what to do based upon the trial court's determination if the plaintiff was unable to go forward. Whether we call that failure of prosecution or whether we don't, the court had options. It could continue the case, it could dismiss it. And if it chose to dismiss it, it could do so with or without prejudice. The trial court delegated the decision to defense counsel. It did not say you fellas will try to figure out whether or not you can agree on the trial. It delegated the decision to defense counsel. Plaintiff pointed this out in the brief, memorandum, in support of the motion to reconsider that the trial court had done that. And the trial court rendered its decision out of rule and did not deny that it had delegated the decision to defense counsel.
I'm trying not to understand the technical aspects of what happened and what your view is of what was in the trial court's mind. Is it your claim that the trial court felt its only option on dismissal was with prejudice, and that's why it went on to say, I'm not going to do it with prejudice?
No, I think the trial court knew that it had the option, it had three options. Continue the case to dismiss it with prejudice or dismiss it without prejudice. And the judge said,
I'm not going to dismiss it.
You guys go over, and if you can agree on sanctions, then I won't dismiss it. If you don't, come back.
When it came back, this is the quote that's in the brief, I'm going to dismiss the case under a failure to prosecute, and I will not put any other proviso on that dismissal. I believe the rule says that's with prejudice, but I'm not going to dismiss it with prejudice. I'm going to dismiss it under Rule 41 for failure to prosecute.
That's what the court said, and I think the court was clearly in error because by not putting in the magic words without prejudice, it became with prejudice. And I don't know why the trial court didn't recognize that because it was one of the trial court
completely. But he did recognize it. It sounds to me like he did recognize it.
He
said, I know that's with prejudice.
I think he did.
Yeah.
I think that he knew that he was dismissing it with prejudice, but he didn't want to say those words on the record.
Yeah.
What other reason, I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. Right.
But he clearly understood he had other options.
I think he understood he had other options, but he chose to delegate his decision to defense counsel.
Well, but why when I think what the Chief's asking you is, why isn't the better rule for us to leave some discretion here in the hands of the trial court who has a feel? I mean, you're both hamstrung by what's not in the record here. The trial court has a real sense of what's been going on here, whether somebody's been dilatory or not, and all of that. Okay, why shouldn't we leave some discretion?
First of all, I think you should leave a great deal of discretion, and the trial court should only be reversed for an abuse of that discretion. The question here is, did the trial court abuse its discretion? Does the record show this contumacious, dilatory disregard of the system which the case law requires? Justice Resnick in one case suggested...
That's standard. You're kind of reversing the normal abuse of discretion standard, and that's maybe what's interesting about dismissals. That you cite as that standard that it has to be contumacious. Now, that's somewhat different than the normal abuse of discretion standard that we apply, which says that we review the decision of the trial court as to whether or not it is unreasonable, arbitrary, capricious. So that's a whole, that's really a very different viewpoint, isn't it, that you
cite? Perhaps I'm confusing two different things. What, in order to make a finding to justify a dismissal of prejudice, the case law has said that there must be a finding of this kind of consummation behavior on the part of plaintiff or his counsel, or there is an abuse of discretion. That's what the cases say. And when the failure, that if there is no evidence to support that kind of consummationness,
it becomes unreasonable.
Then it becomes unreasonable and is an abuse of discretion. That's what our Court of Appeals said. We carried a heavy burden in the Court of Appeals to satisfy that court that there was an abuse. The defendants defaulted on the second assignment of error about delegation of judicial authority to the defense counsel. They did not disagree that that's what had happened. It is our assertion that this is absolutely inexcusable, and this court should not permit and should not endorse delegation of judicial decisions to opposing counsel. It goes against the very basic premises of the adversary system. The defendant put no argument before the Court of Appeals opposing the second assignment of error, did not contradict our assertion that such a delegation had been made. The defense took an appeal to this court and filed a memorandum in support of jurisdiction and never mentioned the second assignment of error in which the Court of Appeals found that this discretion was delegated to the court. And now for the first time in their brief on the merits, they say there was no such delegation. Simply assert that the record clearly shows that the trial court delegated this to the defense counsel.
You've used your time, Mr. Pease. Mr. Walsh, you've saved about a minute of your time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Two quick points. First, plaintiff continues to assert that what we're saying is that 41B requires a dismissal with prejudice for a failure to prosecute. That's not what we're saying. What we're saying is the trial court cannot be held to abuse of discretion when he follows the rule as written. That's what we're saying. Secondly, regarding the delegation of authority, there was no delegation. There's nothing in the record which indicates that either. Even Mr. P's affidavit says that we should go back and try to work it out. That's not, you go back and decide. The trial court is saying, federal, I'll leave it up to you. You get to see the judge today.
The go back and work it out, I mean, it was, he was, the setup at that point was you had no reason to compromise. When it's go back and work it out, he's got the sword hanging over the plaintiff's head at this point, very clearly from what he said at the end. So you have no reason to go back in the room and do anything other than saying, it looks like I'm having a heck of a good day at the courthouse.
Well, Your Honor, I would disagree with that, simply because at that point in time, Mr. Earl didn't know what the trial was going to do. As far as I can tell from the record, and I wasn't there that day, but as far as I can tell from the record, the trial court simply said, you go work it out. He hadn't made the decision yet, from what I can tell. Now, if he had made the decision, Mr. Earl has to think, okay, I've got an opportunity to get some money out of this guy for a case that probably is never going to be proven against my client anyway, or I can sit tight and take my chance with the trial court dismissing this case with prejudice. I mean, we didn't know that was going to happen until it happened. So Mr. Earl was taking a chance, and I would agree it's probably a small chance. I mean, granted, this plaintiff didn't appear to have any kind of evidence, so the chances of him ever proving this case were slim to none. But that isn't the issue
on that point that would the trial court have been, would the trial court have abused its discretion if he had dismissed the case without giving the defendant and the plaintiff's attorney a chance to work it out?
I agree with that.
Wouldn't that be your strongest argument? It doesn't matter what the defendant and the plaintiff did. The trial court was would have been justified in dismissing the case without having the two of you go and probably hope you'd settle it, I suppose. Who knows? But isn't that an answer to that issue or not?
I would agree. Definitely. I mean, at this point, the trial court saying, look, just try to work it out. He wants both parties to be satisfied with what happens. We don't want people going to court and coming back a day later and one side feeling like they really got taken, that they really had the thing wrapped up against them. And in this case, if the trial court had dismissed this case without prejudice, party that got tabled here, my clients, Dr. Harvey and McConnell. They were the ones who prepared for the trial. They were the ones that did the discovery. They're the ones that sent the rock court and tried to figure out what this case was about and what was the malpractice. So yes, Your Honor, I'll answer that in your firm.
Thank you, Mr. Walsh.
Again, we simply reassert our conclusion that the universal trial court.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised our opinion.